You're listening to The Bill Murphy Show, the daily music interview show featuring the best in the business. From behind the scenes, in the studio, and on the stage. Available by subscription for free on iTunes and at BillMurphyShow.com. Brought to you by Lulu's Bait Shack, fresh Florida seafood and live music on A1A on world-famous Fort Lauderdale Beach. And now, here's your host, Bill Murphy.
With your digital broadcast for Thursday, July 7th, 2011. And I'd like to thank my good buddy Scott Chapin for those opens and closes, as usual. And while we were mentioning Lulu's, want to encourage listeners to go to the Lulu's link on the page for a great special. You can go have a night at Lulu's half price, courtesy of the show and Lulu's Bait Shack. Also, take advantage of a great special. Those of you who are local and want to play some golf when it stops raining, you can go enjoy Seven Bridges at Springtree in Sunrise, a newly renovated par 3 course. You can get in and out of there in about 2.5-3 hours and enjoy like really, really high-quality golf in a very competitive executive format. So take advantage of that and, you know, just show some appreciation to our sponsors of the show. We have made a recent shift exclusively and primarily to music, and we're going to do that hopefully every day, as close to every day as we possibly can. We know, because that's what you wanted, that's what you responded to mostly, and so we're going to continue with that and keep music alive in South Florida and all over the world, for that matter, as we get inside the music, and we do that once again as I welcome my guest today. I'm looking forward to this. I get to reminisce again, as I get to do once in a while on this show with some of my peers that I've worked with in radio over the years. Glenn Richards calls us from the University of Florida, air personality, programmer for Rock 104. Interrupt me, Glenn, if I get any of this wrong. Producer for WRUF AM and FM Gainesville. An instructor, most importantly, and this is probably the most interesting part of the conversation, of rock and roll and American society and mass media and you at the University of Florida. He's a grad of the University of Miami, radio production instructor and air personality, music collector, fact checker, historian, notable South Florida classic rocker. And he's been a morning show producer for notable shows here in the South Florida area. There you go. There's all my notes. Glenn, that's the end of the show.
Thanks for having me on. It was great.
How did I do? Is that all accurate?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, cool. Let's get right to this little interesting fact. I know that you are a grad of the U of M and a very proud grad, I might add. And you were there when it really first got started and kind of were one of the original students there and part of the whole music scene as it got off the ground. Now, is there any sort of a personal conflict of interest with you now, you know, being stationed in Gainesville at the University of Florida?
No.
No. Okay.
I mean, in what regard?
Well, I know. You know how it is. The U of M. I guess you got that triad in Florida, the University of Miami, Gainesville, and FSU. I guess all of that rivalry kind of stays on the football field and doesn't really extend into your career?
It's around elsewhere, but as far as I'm concerned, we have one major thing in common, and that's that we both hate FSU.
Oh, okay. That's what it is. So the Gainesville, the Gators, and the Hurricanes kind of gang up on the Seminoles. That's how it is.
Yeah, I see it. That's not necessarily the way they see it. you know, the way I feel is when I moved up here, all of a sudden they started winning championships.
So
the Miami Karma. And all of a sudden, the basketball team starts winning. Baseball team starts going to Omaha twice, you know, back to back. Football team wins championships. Started to feel a little more at home with all the championships.
Well, how about that? So I guess you can go ahead and take some of the credit for that.
I will.
Excellent. Let's compare. You were, I mean, I'm not exactly sure what years you attended the University of Miami, but I know that it was a kind of a fledgling school at the time and was sort of new and, you know, kind of.
I didn't go there in the 1920s.
Well, okay. All right. Let's put it this way. That really wasn't.
University by the time I got there in 1980.
Okay, I guess I'm confusing the start of their football program with the start of the school. I guess the school started a lot sooner than the football program did.
I see what you're saying. Yeah. No. Well. Yeah. Jim Kelly was still there when I got there, and then they started winning. Yeah. Schnellenberger came in, and then it was the glory the glory years.
And also, what was really taking off the time you were there, and I know you were a big part of it, was the music scene. There was a very noted school radio station there. I'm sure there still is to some degree. And how would you compare what was going on in the days when you were at the U of M to what's happening now in Gainesville?
Wow. Musically, you mean?
Yeah, music scene-wise.
Well, Gainesville music scene's been established for a lot longer. You're right. I mean, it was just coming along back then. College radio was just starting to grow into its own in the late 70s and the early 80s. And it was an exciting time musically because, you know, that's when the punk thing happened in the late 70s and then the new wave thing in the early 80s. And the radio kind of like went along with that. College radio was a big part of the growth of new music, what became, you know, known as alternative music in the 90s and such.
Right.
And the local scene, you know, there'd always been a local scene. I mean, I was too young to really understand what it was all about, but I guess it was the early 80s when Critical Mass got signed.
Right.
Had a couple of other cool bands, the Johnny Depp and his band The Kids were happening, and they thought they'd go to L.A. and make it, and he did, but they didn't. And,
right.
You know, a couple other bands here and there, Zed Cars. I'm going to forget people, but, you know.
Wow, I would have completely forgot about Zed Cars till you just mentioned them. What a blast from the past that is.
Yeah, there's a lot of great bands. And Charlie Pickett, The Eat, Thick Lids. So there's, you know, and they were like part of that whole punk and new wave thing that was going on. So there was a lot of that happening, but there wasn't, you know, the Cameo Theater in South Beach hadn't started its you know, revival yet. I mean, all that stuff happened, you know, along the same time. So, you know, those clubs weren't established yet. There was like Flynn's and a couple of other places for, you know, these punk bands to play. You know, but then it really kind of clicked in the late 80s and the early 90s, and that's when we had, you know, Nuclear Valdez and Saigon Kick and Marilyn Manson and Forget the Name and The Goods and Mary Carlson and Nalara and, you know, just exploded. So it takes a while, you know, you plant the seed and then it grows. And definitely that seed started in the late 70s and then the early 80s when I got there. And that's when VUM changed its format to, you know, that, quote, college radio format.
Uh-huh.
College Media Journal, CMJ, had just started like the very late 70s and was just coming into its own. For those who don't know, it's kind of like a radio tip sheet or newsletter kind of thing for radio programmers, but for college radio programmers.
Right, so right.
Developing on its own as a format, record companies were looking at it as a viable place to break new artists. You know, we played a lot of bands first before they made it onto commercial radio, sometimes months, but sometimes years, you know, like REM or U2. Duran Duran, Adam and the Ants.
Yeah, and I think you sort of touched on it. You sort of touched on it, but I guess, and it wasn't exclusive to University of Miami. I think it was going on in many parts of the country that sort of made that college radio sort of made alternative radio acceptable and kind of gave it its birth in the 80s. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. It was the underground. It was the forerunner. You know, it was the proving ground, the testing area for the record companies, anyway, you know, to see, well, if it made it, if you could develop a buzz on, you know, college radio, then you'd have a story to sell to the mainstream radio.
Right.
Look, they're really popular on the college radio stations, and you should give it a chance.
Yeah, and the record labels must have loved it because it worked as a little testing ground for them in that matter.
Absolutely, and then you had your major commercial stations that were doing it, like K-Rock in L.A., they were having success with it, and they would try to branch it out to, you know, other mainstream stations. So It took a while, and then, you know, but like anything that develops, you know, rock and roll in its early years was fermenting, if you will, and then exploded when Elvis Presley, you know, came on the scene. But there had been, you know, little bits and pieces of the puzzle getting put together prior to that, and then bam, you know, the doors came off the hinges. Same thing again in the early 60s with the Beatles. Same thing again in the early 90s with Nirvana.
Right.
You know, or the late 70s with the Sex Pistols and Elvis Costello and the Clash.
And I guess you sort of corrected me here because I thought that University of Miami would have been a forerunner But you're telling me that there's a much more of a music history at the University of Florida than there ever was at University of Miami.
No, I'm not as far as radio goes.
Okay.
No, it's two different things. No, VOM was absolutely a forerunner of, you know, college radio.
That's what I thought, okay.
And still is. I mean, they just won an MTVU Woody Award for college radio, best college radio station in the country. So they're still at the forefront of college radio, which I'm very proud to say. You know, but prior to that time, I mean, it was only 10 years into the existence of the station. It started in 68, and so by the late 70s, 1980, when I actually got there, the summer of 1980, it was still kind of doing its underground FM radio thing, you know,
right,
throughout the 70s, like any other progressive FM station, you know, playing album sides and Grateful Dead albums and Springsteen and, you know, Genesis and all that kind of great classic rock, 70s progressive rock and whatnot.
Yeah.
And they were also playing, like, you know, the new Elvis Costello or Joe Jackson and these groups, but they were playing it all of it all together, and which was fine. And then it was 1980, 79, 80 when WSHE, you know, went corporate, got sold. And the new owners brought in, you know, Lee Abrams and changed it to the Superstars format. And Neil Mirsky came in and tightened up the playlist. And, I mean, so it's a microcosm of, I mean, it's what was going on all over the country.
Right.
You know, progressive FM underground stations were tightening up playlists and becoming commercial. They were becoming like top 40 rock stations as opposed to top 40 pop stations. They were, you know, tightening everything up.
And you sort of became part of that regime. How did you make the transition from the University of Miami? Did you go directly to the trailer park there? Because I know we worked together there in very, very early years of my career.
Yeah, I was on academic probation because I was spending more time
at the
radio station. Spending more time at the radio station than I was, you know,
okay,
in classes.
Nice of you to admit that.
Yeah, well, you know, hey, I graduated. So I was like, you know, I should probably take some time off. And so I wanted to do radio for real, and ended up Ruby Cheeks. Remember her?
Oh yeah,
from
K102, right?
He played a record late night she probably wasn't supposed to play, and it was like the kind of thing that we were playing on VOM. And I was like, oh my god, this woman's cool. So I called her up, and anyway, we got to talking. It was back when people used telephones. I couldn't email her.
Right.
Actually called her and, you know, told her what I was doing. And she was like, oh, I'll listen to your tapes and all that kind of thing. So she would coach me and stuff and let me know that they were having, they were looking for somebody for weekends. And I applied and I didn't get the job. And then I went back and worked. And people at VOM looking at me sideways like, what is wrong with you? You sound like you're on a commercial radio station. I'm like, really? Oh,
wow.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm thinking to myself, that's the idea.
Well, because you were working on your chops at the time.
I was trying to make tapes, and I went back in, and I don't remember, who was the program director then?
Ooh.
It was before Brian Illis, but it was, I want to say Buddy Hollis.
Yes, I think you're correct. I think Buddy Hollis is the name that's actually, you're bringing back a lot of names from the past that I haven't heard in decades, but yes. I believe you're correct.
You know, he was like, wow, I don't know what you did, but, you know, he gave me a job. So it was weekends, overnights, and that kind of thing. So that was my foot in the door. And then when K102 changed format, Andy Geary and I were the only two rock jocks that they kept for the new format. When Magic 102 in its early days was like a top 40 station, like Midwestern top 40 station. It didn't last very long.
Wow.
And before they switched to oldies. And and I didn't last very long. I was there about 6 months and then kept applying for jobs at WSHE, and finally Michael D'Alfonso called me in, and I went in, and I, you know, so I was out of work at K102 for a couple of months. Our pal Loose Bruce, Bruce Harmon,
right,
hooked me up with a gig at Artstock's Playpen.
Oh, yeah.
DJing for spring break, and I think it was by that summer I had finally gotten weekend gig at WSHE, and the rest, they say, is history.
Yeah, and then I guess you're just putting the timetable back together for me, because I was under the impression that you were at SHE before I was, but it's that's not true. You were actually at K102 while I was beginning my stuff over at SHE on the weekend, so Then we ended up together there at the station for a couple of years.
That's the way it works in this business. Yeah, it was like 83 to 86 at K102 and then Magic for 6 months. And then, yeah, and then she from 86 to 93.
And we both kind of did the work in the clubs at the same time to supplement the very pitiful radio income, so.
Yeah, I was doing that. Art Stocks was my first experience doing that. And mostly I'd been working in record stores all my career, if you will.
Oh, yeah. Do you remember you being at Peaches at the... And then you were also, did you do Specs later on in that?
I did Specs. I had a lot of friends that worked at Specs, but I worked at Peaches and then Yesterday and Today Records on Bird Road.
Wow, fantastic. And now, I'm going to kind of fast forward a little bit here. I know there's a lot that happened in between, but I'm fascinated by the fact that you have what's got to be the coolest teaching job ever, teaching rock and roll in American society and mass media, and you, a couple of the courses that you've been involved with at the University of Florida. I mean, that has just got to be something that is you just take pleasure in every single day.
Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah, it's it just kind of fell in my lap, and yeah.
Am I just not hip to what's going on in colleges these days? Is this a common thing to find a course like this in a major school like University of Florida?
Yeah, there's actually other schools that have bigger programs, pop culture programs. This is just like one pop culture class here. But the former chairman of the former chair of the journalism department, William McKean, that's his thing. He's written several books. Rock and Roll is Here to Stay is a great anthology that he put together.
Oh, yeah.
And several others. And he just basically turned it into a class. I mean, he was in charge. He could do that. So he created a class in the journalism department. And it's the kind of thing, the way universities are going now, is it's all about getting butts in the seats.
Mm-hmm.
And when you've got a class that can attract people from outside your college, you know, across other departments, you know, as an elective, that's a good thing. So it started as a graduate level class, and then just the popularity grew over the years, and he turned it into a, you know, a class for undergraduates and stuff. And I just took his class once because I wanted to take it. I'd been seeing the flyers and hearing about it, and I'm like, I got to take this class. I took one at UM. There was a class like that at UM. Actually, back in the early 80s, history of rock, and then they also had a history of jazz.
Wow.
And so, yeah, it's something that's been around for a while. So I took his class, and I needed to do something on a graduate level, you know, to warrant my being allowed to take the class. And so what I did was, all I did was create a Facebook page for the class. He didn't have anything online.
Wow.
Wasn't using any sort of online element. So I just created a Facebook page, and he's like, hey, well, we'll make that your graduate level thing. So I'm like, okay. So I did that, and then at the end of the class, he was like, hey, how would you like to take over teaching it? You want to teach it over the summer? I need a break. And I'm like, yeah, and? What's the catch? So I taught it, and then he was just like, hey, why don't you keep going with it? So I was fortunate enough to do it for 2.5 years.
Now, what kind of observations are you making of the college-aged students that, you know, in their association with music of today, what is it that they're, I don't know, any observations, good or bad, about their, you know, involvement with music and how well they take to the history as you teach it?
I mean, it's like it's always been. I mean, I'm sure you and people of our age group, to use an academic term, are cohorts.
Uh-huh.
You know, kind of think, oh, the kids today, the music they listen to is crap. There's no good music. Everything was good when we were young, and now it's all crap. It's all the same. This is what one of the themes in the class that I have is that the reaction that people had to rock and roll originally is no different than the reaction they had to the music that the youth loved in the 20s, which was jazz.
Right.
Oh, it's going to ruin music, and it's the devil's music. And then they said the same thing about rock, and then they said the same thing about heavy metal, and they said the same thing about hip-hop, and they continue to say the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all the same, even though the sounds keep changing. So kids want their own music. They want their own style and way of talking, their own language and all that sort of thing. And it, music still fulfills that function. But just like any group anywhere, you're always going to get some people who just don't know anything about the history of anything, and those who are, like, eager to learn. You know, like when I was a kid and I listened to the Beatles and I would, you know, look at every single thing about that was written about them on the record albums or in magazines and whatnot. We didn't have websites back then.
Right.
And I'd see, like, who's this Chuck Berry? They're doing all these songs by this guy, Chuck Berry. And I would go and look up Chuck Berry. And the same thing with Buddy Holly and the same thing with Little Richard. And kids still do that today. You know, they'll, like, buy a Green Day record, and they'll be like, oh, they're doing a cover of this band. Who is this band? And they'll, like, go and track down Bob Dylan.
Right.
So, you know, that's how I, you know, taught myself a lot about rock music history, is just through my heroes.
Just history repeating itself.
Yeah, you know, I mean, because artists are going to play songs that influence them. And, you know, where do they get it from? Because until they become, you know, good songwriters on their own, they're going to, like, do covers. I mean, the Beatles were a cover band when they started out, you know, and people deride cover bands, but everybody was a cover band. So, you know, but I go and try to figure out, like, well, why is this so important to them? You know, they're important to me. This guy, Buddy Holly, was important to them. He must be worth my interest, or else they wouldn't be interested in him, you know?
Uh-huh.
And the same thing with Elvis Costello or The Police or any other band that I like, and I find out, why are they doing this cover? Oh, they like this guy. Who is this guy then? And I'll go and find out about it. And kids are the same way like that. They're still like that today. You've got kids that are like that, and then you've got the other kids who are like, they don't know the name of the band that does their favorite song. You know, they're taking the class because their friend told them it was easy.
Right, right, right.
So, well, that, you get that everywhere. It's all the same. So it's really kind of encouraging, and especially when you run into the kids who, you know, they really do know the Doors.
Right.
Like, how do you know the Doors? Oh, my parents used to play them all the time.
Well, that's something I want to touch on a little bit. And again, I run the risk of us falling into that category of, you know, our music is better than yours kind of thing. But in honesty, and you've had an overall look at it over the past few decades now, and now you're, you know, teaching the kids of today about it. What is it about the music, the classic rock in particular, from, I guess, mainly the mid to late 70s that really, really sticks today, and people do know the music and they are familiar with it and it sticks? Are you still of the belief, like I am, that everything that's gone on in the last 10 or 15 years has no chance of having the staying power that music did?
No.
You're not?
No, I don't feel that.
Okay. So do you think, so then you're saying that a couple of generations from now that, I don't know, to use an example, maybe it's a bad one, but that these kids will be recognizing Creed songs and Foo Fighters records and Nirvana?
Foo Fighters and Nirvana. Probably not Creed or Nickelback, but Foo Fighters and Nirvana, yeah. You know, it's hard to tell because it takes at least 10 or 15 years before you can get a perspective. I mean, some of the kids in the class are, a colleague of mine started a part two of the rock class. The one that I taught only went up to 1970. And there was a lot of people who were like, oh, but, you know, God, you're just getting going. So this PhD student started a part two of the class, which went from 1970 to 1990. And a lot of the kids were like, well, you know, but you don't get into grunge. You don't get into, like, you know, the 90s stuff. And he's trying to explain to them, like, it's still too soon.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, just now it's 20 years, and you can get a little perspective on the groups that really meant something or that had a contribution and an impact. So the groups, the really new groups today, or the last 10 years, I mean, who knows? But I mean, Metallica for sure.
Oh, yeah, okay.
You know, people ask, like, well, what are you going to be teaching about, you know, 20 years from now? And, you know, probably The Strokes will probably be in there, you know, in the conversation. The White Stripes will probably be in the conversation. You know, it's really hard to say. I mean, don't hold me to it, but probably groups like that, you know, because they changed, the game changed after they came on the scene.
You know, and it'll be interesting to see how that happens, how that tradition carries on with all the new media, the way it works. I mean, obviously the radio stations, like the oldie stations, for instance, the other day I heard on Magic 102 down here, which was the greatest hits of the 60s and 70s, they're no longer saying of the 60s and 70s anymore, it's just greatest hits. And I heard a Supertramp song on there, so I thought, oh, here's part of the transition going on right here. So
it's only natural. I mean, as the demographic ages and changes,
right?
You know, The classic rock station up here, you know, plays Guns N' Roses and Pearl Jam.
Right.
And Red Hot Chili Peppers. You know, I mean, think about it. The Red Hot Chili Peppers started in the mid-80s.
Yeah.
They're classic rock. But that's the way it goes. I mean, and it's amazing that groups like that or Green Day can have the staying power and continued impact that they have now, considering how long they've been around. Look at U2.
Right.
You know, used to be when a group got to be U2's age, it was like, yeah, please, you know, we're not interested. And there's a large contingent of people that are still like, oh, those old fogies are at it again, Bono and his whole trip. But look at what they did at you know, Sun Life Stadium a couple of weeks ago. So it's different. Bands can still pull them in. Paul McCartney, you know, still pulling them in. So it is a little bit different now in that groups, I don't know, are able to, you know, maybe they're taking rock Viagra or something. I don't know. But
And I mean, the good ones will have a little bit more power with all the different ways that people get music in their hands as opposed to just traditional wait till it comes on the radio like it was when we were younger. But so it'll be interesting to see how the transition goes. You know, I feel a whole lot more optimistic about it after talking to you. And again, I don't have to have that much of that, these kids today attitude. You seem to be a little more optimistic than I thought you would be.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm very optimistic. I mean, there's a lot of great music coming out. I mean, there's a lot of great music that's out. The White Stripes, you know, alone, just what Jack White accomplishes. I mean, look what, he is such a throwback to a bygone era. I mean, they do covers of blues artists on their earlier albums, you know. I mean, so kids that are into getting into the White Stripes, I mean, now, I mean, they're even old.
You know, and I missed the White Stripes bus the first time around, and I watched it, Might Get Loud, obviously, to see Jimmy Page, and I walked away from it more impressed with Jack White than anybody else in that movie. It was very impressive.
You go and listen to the Elephant album, and it's like listening, it's like, wow, this guy grew up worshiping Led Zeppelin, didn't he? And
right.
Music of the 70s, and what he's doing is taking that and putting it into, you know, early 2000s. You know, and anybody that does a Howlin' Wolf song, you know, it's like, what does this kid know about Howlin' Wolf? You know,
yeah.
You know, growing up in Detroit, you better know something about the blues and the history. So, it's out there. You know, I mean, just even Green Day on their first album, you know, first or second album, they were doing a Who cover, and I mean, that speaks volumes of where they're coming from. You know, and just look at the artists that they cover in concert or that they've done covers of: John Lennon, Chuck Berry, Bob Dylan. It's like, and then you listen to the you know, American Idiot. I mean, that's a protest album. That is just drenched with Bob Dylan, you know. I mean, so
yeah.
It might be hard to recognize. It's not like so in your face, like, oh, they're totally John Lennon fans. But if you, like, pull away the pop punk and whatever, it's like, and get down to the core of what's going on, it's as pure and authentic and genuine as any of the stuff that you grew up, you know, listening to and liking. But every generation's going to put their spin on it. The Beatles put their spin on 50s rock. You know, the 50s bands put their spin on 40s blues and R&B.
Right.
You know, and, you know, it came out sounding like, what is this? It's not blues. It's not rhythm and blues. No, it's new. It's rock and roll.
And I think more importantly, there's more of a reflection of the culture going on with today's music than I may be even recognizing. You know, Green Day is a perfect example of that as well. I've been waiting for this, for everything going on in the world and the culture to be, you know, reflected in the music like it was in the 60s and 70s. And I guess more of that's going on than I'm, you know, caring to pay attention to.
Well, maybe, but it's not as in your face, or maybe it's
true.
There's so much other stuff going on at the same time, it's hard to see it because there's just so many other outlets. I mean,
right.
You know, excuse me, had to cough.
No, go ahead. Go right ahead. It's a podcast. You can do anything you want. You can curse if you want.
You can edit that, right?
Yeah, of course I can.
Okay, good. I can edit this then.
But isn't it so much more fun to not edit it and leave it in there? It just brings the listener closer to us.
I have an image to maintain.
Okay.
I'm a family guy.
I will do that, respectfully.
No, but seriously, the you know, I think it's, I mean, back in the 60s, you had three television sets, you know? I mean, that was it, three channels.
Yeah.
And now you've got four networks and 50,000 cable and internet stations. So it's a lot more diffuse. I mean, we're... We call the release of Sgt. Pepper in June of 67 a moment of unity in the for the Western world.
Uh-huh.
Dr. McKean, that's for his part of the class.
Gotcha.
You know, but if you think about it, if you wanted the new Beatles record, you had to go to the store and get it the day it came out. There were no advanced leaks. There was no internet leaks. There was no
MP3s being passed around, right?
There was no exclusive first look on Entertainment Tonight or Access Hollywood and all that kind of thing. You know, in the studio with the Beatles, getting ready for the release. No, it was just you waited. There was no rock press for one thing. So the Beatles hadn't toured. They hadn't put out a record in 6 months. Everybody was like, what are they up to?
Right.
So they had to, wait and see what was going on. So, yeah, the whole world, think about it, was like waiting for the Beatles' new album for 6 months. That doesn't happen today.
That's absolutely true.
You know, it's like, oh, the new Beyonce album's coming out. And, you know, but it's like...
Right. Our attention is diverted so many different ways that I often miss new releases by bands I would want to hear anyway, you know?
Right, right. Unless you've got that RSS feed that, you know, sends you an email when it's coming out.
Right.
So on the one hand, we've got more ways to access more information, but maybe also it's too much information. It's like, how many music blogs can you keep track of?
Right.
You know, how many emails can you get? How many RSS feeds to find out? I mean... Yeah, it's crazy.
It's a blessing and a curse, I'll tell you. Well, Glenn, you've really, really filled us with a whole lot more information than I even anticipated here. It's fascinating stuff. I can hear it in your voice that you have a lot of passion in this. Is there a way anybody can anyone on Facebook go ahead and like that class page that you have?
Yeah, but we're actually letting Facebook archive it because I'm going to be moving on from teaching the class.
Okay.
My assistantship is up, so I'm not going to be teaching it anymore. And,
well, then what kind of online presence do you have where people can keep up with you and what you're doing?
I have my own Facebook page. They can look me up there.
Okay.
Just Facebook.com/Glenn Richards.
And we'll put a link there because, I mean, I remember you and I standing, crossover shift changes at SHE, and we would stand there for hours comparing notes on the stuff we read on liner notes and albums and stuff. And I know that you've got a wealth of information. I guess you're that go-to guy for the trivia question on, who was the drummer on this song again? You know, so I know a lot of people would appreciate that about you.
Well, yeah, if they want to, I have something they want to know about.
That's, of course, if they come to me first and I can't answer them. I'll say go to Glenn.
Yeah, I mean, whenever I'm searching for stuff all the time, I'm just online, and just whenever I just see something, I'm not necessarily looking for it. I'll just, like, throw a link up there to like a wacky article or something cool, or I see that Robert Smith has contributed a song to a tribute album for John Martin. It's like, oh, I like Robert Smith and I've heard of John Martin, and I'll just throw the link up there because I know I've got other friends who like Robert
right
Smith, and so if they don't know about it, I'll put it out there so they can find it, so stuff like that.
Is that actually true?
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. Nice little a little known fact. I wanted to close with a little story from you or two. Over your career, you've had an opportunity to work with the immensely successful Paul and Young Ron show when it was on Zeta, and on, I guess you were there when they were on Big for a little while, right?
Nope.
Oh, okay, just at Zeta. And then also with Julie Guy at Coast 97.3 as a morning show producer, a very, very fascinating job as well, where you were in charge of booking guests, among other duties as well, but you were in charge of booking guests, a lot of them very high-profile celebrities. What I was going to ask you, do you have any stories you can share with us about dealing with high-profile celebrities? And for instance, like a favorite story about calling someone and trying to get them booked on the show, and any interesting conversations that may have taken place?
Boy, oh boy.
Putting you on the spot.
Yeah. I
guess it all went perfectly well then, huh?
No, not at all. Yeah, it was like a nightmare.
Really?
Well, it's just...
cancellations must have been,
Well, that was always a problem. But no, the problem was that a lot of the timing on it was, West Coast versus East Coast.
Right.
They would have people that'd be available, and they'd give you a guest, like from a network TV guest or something, to promote a show that was on that night.
Yeah.
Well, but we're a 6 to 9 a.m. morning show, 6 to 10... And, it's like we, can't we record it? And that was a pain in the butt trying to organize stuff like that, because it's like you really want this guest, but they don't want you to record it because they want it aired that day. But, you know, so...
Right. That could tend to be very stressful, I would imagine.
Yeah, and then also stressful in that they would put out their emails at like 4 in the afternoon, which would be like 1 o'clock their time. You know, they'd get into the office, they'd figure out what they got to do for the day, go to lunch, come back, and then send out the emails to all the, you know, all over the country. And it'd be like usually a 2-hour window.
Right.
That they'd be available. And 7-minute interview. So how many is that an hour? So it was like 20 slots, 15 to 20 slots. And if you're not one of the first 15 or 20 stations to email back, yes, we want to get, you know, Kevin James, then you wouldn't get Kevin James. You know, and then there's also the thing where you have to take, like, the D-level guest who's, you know, some up-and-coming actor in a movie that stars the big star that you want, but you have to take this D-level guy, and next time around we'll get you maybe a B-level guy.
Right.
You know, so there's always that kind of game going back and forth, and Paul and Ron are like, you know, what are you doing? You're killing us. Why aren't we getting, you know, the big-name guy? I'm like, well, let's see. The big-name guy is sitting on a couch with Dave. You know? So it's like... Well, we want to talk to Adam Sandler. Well, we can't talk to Adam Sandler. We'll get Rob Schneider.
I mean, not that it pales in comparison, but I held a similar job for a short time when I was in Dallas at a sports station there, where it actually was just like one of the duties of my board up job that I had there when I did that every once in a while. And Kenny Rogers for the Texas Rangers pitched a perfect game one night, and we were doing a broadcast after, and he picked up somebody's cell phone and called to talk to our hosts and ended up on the phone with me for a couple minutes while we were in commercial break, and said that he was talking to me on the phone going, and we're not even on the air with it. He's going, oh, I'm walking out to the mound right now. I just want to stand there and absorb this for a couple of minutes after he did this pitch, this perfect game. And I'm going, oh, this is such a moment that would have been so much better served on the show.
Right.
Yet you're wasting it on me, the board op here. So I hope you can just kind of reenact that again, because it was so spontaneous when he did it. So I was looking for sort of a similar story to that, where somebody kind of shared information with you or chewed you out for that matter.
No. I mean, you get PR people that are pissed off because, you know, I have no control over Paul and Ron pissing off the guests.
Right.
But what do we have? We had one thing that was really, really cool when I was doing Those Two Girls in the Morning with Julie and it was Michelle back then, but with Julie Guy. And we had Doris Roberts on the show, and we pre-recorded everything. And we did this interview, I think it must have been around Thanksgiving or something. I don't even remember what she was promoting or what the deal was. But we had her on. She was the sweetest, nicest lady. She was amazing. And we did the interview. We were done. We thanked her, blah, blah, blah. She called back to thank us and tell us how much fun she had.
Jeez.
That never happened.
No.
PR person, she called back. I just wanted to say that you guys were great, the girls were great, and I was like, wow.
Right. Not the PR person. She did.
Right.
That's fascinating. That's kind of the first kind of story like that I've ever heard.
And one of the other biggest star you can imagine, and we were fortunate, we got Paul and Ron to go to a hotel in Miami Beach where he was doing interviews, and we were one of the shows that were invited in. And this guy was another one of the sweetest guys you'd ever meet, John Travolta. He was a sweetheart. Nice to all of his people. I mean, I don't know what he's like when people aren't around.
I've heard that about him too, but I didn't know it here firsthand.
He was terrific. And Henry Winkler, we had him in the studio one time, and he was amazing. So I mean, there's for all the airy spirits you get, then you've got like Henry Winkler and a John Travolta and a Doris Roberts. So more often than not, it's good stories, and it's fun. I mean, it's a headache at the time trying to put it all together, but you know, when you put it all together and you make the pieces fit and you land that big guest and it goes off well, it's awesome. And then unfortunately it's like, okay, who's on the show tomorrow?
It just starts right all over again.
Yeah, it starts all over again. It's a hell of a lot of fun.
Great stuff. We're talking with Glenn Richards. Before we wrap up, another reminder that Glenn is working at Rock 104 in Gainesville. What's the present state of affairs up in that radio station now?
I mean, we're not on the air anymore. We got the long story and decisions behind it, and we really didn't get into the differences between college radio in Miami versus University of Florida. But now, actually, University of Florida has an actual college radio station, because it was a commercial rock station for the longest time, but they've changed the format back last fall. So now we're just online, rock104.com, and it's a mainstream rock station. We expanded the playlist. It's kind of almost a hybrid between alternative and mainstream rock.
Oh, cool.
And, you know, live DJs, and that's the thing that I think that, that radio has over something like, and somebody, you know, was asking, well, what's the difference between, why should I listen to rock104.com versus Pandora? And I'm like, well, Pandora's only going to play you the songs you already know.
Right.
And the artists that you already like. And they're not going to tell you that Incubus has a new album coming out next Tuesday, you know, or that, you know, when the Warped Tour is happening in Orlando. And that's what you'll get out of local radio, is that, that local information, hopefully, if they have DJs working there.
Yeah, well, I kind of started playing the closing music for the show here, and then I'm backing off and kind of extending this on a couple minutes here because you bring all this up. And on that note that you're saying about the live DJs, you and I both know that less than a decade ago, the Clear Channels and the big companies of the world were, you know, resorting to voice tracking and using DJs and personalities that weren't even in the same city, much less live. And I think there's a trend of going back to more live local disc jockeys and personalities, right? Are you seeing that trend happen too?
Not as much as I would like to.
Oh, really? Okay.
I mean, I don't know. I haven't been looking for a job until recently. So it's kind of scary still, because, I mean, there's a station in Jacksonville, the alternative station there, that doesn't have disc jockeys.
Ah.
They just run sweepers and promos.
That's a little scary.
And yet they're winning in the market.
Uh-oh.
The rock station here that took over for Rock 104, they have a syndicated morning show. They have a midday guy, an afternoon jock, and a syndicated night show, and then voice-tracked overnight.
Wow.
Two disc jockeys running the whole station.
Interesting. I don't know if you're familiar with the iPhone app called Pocket Tunes, which allows you to kind of punch up any radio station in the country, as long as they're subscribed to this program. In the whole Casey Anthony mayhem, I was kind of flipping back and forth to see what talk stations were doing, and it was amazing. I was going through probably 60 or 70 different talk shows across the country, and it's amazing how many of them were running the same exact syndicated show when I went from station to station, and didn't know as much of that was still going on, you know, as was evident when I was doing this.
The economy is, it's the same in radio. There's no money to hire people.
Right.
I mean, the cuts that our beloved Governor Voldemort put into place, you know, the public radio station and public television here at University of Florida, they had to figure out how to make up $500,000 deficit, you know, because they weren't going to be funded. So they, you know, early retirements, a couple of layoffs, and a couple of people moved to new departments and no new hires.
Wow. Okay, well, you know, I guess there's some of it to be optimistic about, and some of it we'll just have to wait and see what happens, you know. I'm still counting on this whole podcast revolution to take off. But
it's like anything. I mean, if you turn on the radio, you could be thoroughly disgusted by all the auto-tune and think that the whole world is crap, but like all throughout musical history, the really good stuff is bubbling under the surface, and you got to hunt for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's out there, and once you find, you know, one spot, then you can like link to another spot, and then another spot, and another spot. So, I mean, if I happen to throw a link up that helps somebody find something cool, then great. Or if they hear something on rock104.com that piques their interest, I'm trying to put interesting stuff on there, you know, mainstream, and then, you know, some up and coming stuff as well. And there's plenty of other online radio stations that are doing, you know, great stuff.
Right.
Even deeper cuts and such.
Well, there you go. Well, that's how we'll connect the listeners to you. They can check out rock104.com. Also go to your Facebook page, because I know you always post some good memories with YouTube videos and songs. And it's sort of like a mini, you know, a little radio station programming going on there on your Facebook page as well. Glenn Richards, thanks so much for being on the show with me and reminiscing. It's been a great time.
Bill, it's been a blast. Thanks.
Subscribe to the Bill Murphy Show podcast for free at iTunes. You can post comments about today's show, listen to archived episodes, and like the show on Facebook by visiting BillMurphyShow.com. A presentation of Bill Murphy Productions.